Welcome to the Springer Math Podcast. In this month's podcast, our guest is Catherine Leonard, President of the Association for Women in Mathematics and a professor and department chair of computer science at Occidental College in Los Angeles, California. She will be hosted by Dahlia Fish, publishing editor at Springer, New York.
Hi, everyone. I'm thrilled to have Catherine Leonard on the Springer Math Podcast today to talk about her work as well as the Association for Women in Mathematics and its past, present, and future. Catherine Leonard is a mathematician and computer scientist at Occidental College in Los Angeles, California. She is currently both professor and department chair in the Department of Computer Science. In 2012, she received a Henry L. Alder Award for teaching from the Mathematical Association of America, and in 2015, she received the AWM Service Award. Catherine is the current president of the Association for Women in Mathematics and is also the director of the NSF-funded Center for Undergraduate Research in Mathematics. Catherine studies geometric models for computer graphics, computer vision, and data analysis with an emphasis on explainability. Hi, Catherine. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit more, just jumping right into your work, a little more about your background in mathematics and what you're currently interested in researching?
Yeah, so I started out in graduate school thinking that I was going to become a number theorist, so a very abstract mathematical field. And at some point during graduate school, I realized that I could only talk to like five other people about the thing that I was spending most of my time doing. And so I took a little breather. And when I came back, I went into applied math. And as you said, the area of applied math that I work in is geometric modeling, specifically with these kind of computer vision, computer graphics applications. So at the moment, I have two main research threads. One is developing an automated process for shape understanding. So for example, when we see a new object for the first time, we can very easily detect, like if it's an animal, what the head is, what the body is, the arms, the tail, the legs, etc. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult to program a computer to do the same thing. So shape understanding is a way of encapsulating sort of all the pieces of that shape of object recognition and things like that. And then the other thread is in developing methods for interpretable machine learning. So currently the major thrust of machine learning is in neural networks. At least that's what's getting all the headlines. But these are kind of black box algorithms. So they make recommendations, but people don't really know why they're making the recommendations that we're making. And so I do some work in trying to figure out how to take the information that the network is analyzing and figuring out how to translate that into something that humans can understand so that the humans can like verify that the recommendation of the algorithm is good or bad.
Fascinating. What do you enjoy most about that?
Really the interdisciplinarity. I mean, even within, so a bunch of disciplines come into play in both of these areas. I'll just, for simplicity, talk about the shape understanding area. Cognitive science, neuroscience, computer science, math. And even within math, there are many subfields that contribute. And somehow the problem is hard enough that you need all of that. And we still haven't solved it. And I also really like the interplay between the mathematical modeling and the human perception. So the systems that we build to do automated things to match what humans do have to actually match what humans do. And so these kinds of perception things have to match with human perception in some sense. But the kicker is that humans don't agree with each other. Human perception is a really slippery thing. And math, on the other hand, is highly standardized. And so that kind of back and forth conversation I find really fascinating.
It is really fascinating. There's so much balance there. So in addition to doing all this, you're also president of the wonderful Association for Women in Mathematics. Can you tell us a little bit about it as an organization, especially for any international listeners who might not be familiar with it and its work?
Yeah, so the mission of the AWM is to promote women and girls in mathematics. And while we are largely in the United States, and so, for example, staff live in the United States, we're actually an international organization. So we have events all over the world, really.
That's wonderful. And yes, I did notice that, especially in, I don't want to jump ahead too far, but I do want to talk about the AWM 50th anniversary. So this year is the 50th anniversary of the AWM as an organization. Congratulations. So how are you celebrating the anniversary?
Well, sadly, most of our plans were canceled because of the pandemic, but we do have a few things going on this year. We have a monthly online seminar series called We Speak. It's organized by the AWM 50th Anniversary Committee, and it features a woman mathematician each month talking both about her mathematical work and also about her journey to where she is today. So it's kind of both scientific and also kind of personal or human. We also probably one of the reasons we're speaking is that this year we launched a new research journal, La Mathematica, mm-hmm. through Springer. And so the first issue of that will contain invited articles from past AWM presidents and prize winners in honor of the 50th anniversary. We'll have a big party at the next math meetings, the joint math meetings in January. Hopefully that this can be in person, and we'll have a launch party for La Mathematica. And then our biennial research symposium should have happened this summer, like right now, basically. But we'll postpone it until next summer, and we'll have a belated birthday party for ourselves there.
Wonderful. That sounds like a lot of fun. So it's nice you get to extend the celebration a little bit.
That's a good way to look at it.
And then there's also an upcoming volume in honor of the 50th anniversary.
Yes.
That I happen to be working on, which I'm really looking forward to. And yes, that definitely attuned me to the international nature of the AWM and its work. There are contributions from everywhere. And I noticed that one of those contributions comes from you. Could you tell us a little bit about your contribution to the 50th anniversary volume?
Yeah, so the editors really wanted contributions from all the presidents or the past presidents. And so even though it was during the pandemic and I was barely hanging on, I found some time to write. So I wrote about my own journey to find a place in the math world. And, you know, spoiler, was not all smooth sailing. And then talked a little bit about the key ways that AWM facilitated that sense of belonging eventually. And then I also kind of made it a bit of a call to the next generation to keep on doing this work and to join organizations like AWM who have the infrastructure and the relationships and kind of the history and the profile to make things happen more quickly, more easily than if people try to do things all by themselves.
Wonderful. That sounds great. I'm really looking forward to reading it. As you mentioned, the last year has been really difficult for researchers for so many reasons, but it's been noted that it's been particularly difficult for women in research. So what kinds of challenges have you had to overcome in your own work?
So I was department chair at the same time as being AWM president-elect and then president, and so the bureaucratic workload was absolutely unbelievable. But in addition, and probably the thing that was most challenging for me, is that there was a significant emotional component. So mm-hmm. I was working with, you know, 120, 150 students and faculty, and they were all at various times feeling like their worlds were falling mm-hmm. apart. And even more so with the George Floyd and other killings that happened over the past year. So just the, you know, I had to be 100% always completely present and relaxed and happy and able to support people. So that was challenging. And as a result, I made almost no progress on research last year. The progress I did make was largely due to the support of my amazing and extremely patient collaborators. So this summer, I'm launching into a sabbatical, so hopefully I can climb back up that research hill and get back on track.
That's great, and it's so nice to hear about supportive collaborators. Do you have any overall advice for the research community on what they can do to better support individual researchers?
Yeah, so I think that different things are required for people at different levels. So a lot of graduate students also didn't get a lot of research done this year, but their funding is tied to a clock. And so finding ways to find an additional year of support for graduate students, same for postdocs, helping graduate students and postdocs who and early career mathematicians who weren't able to give talks in the last year really quickly reintegrate into the research communication pipelines. I think that's really important. And then for those, I know that there, like, I kept reading headlines about certain people like publishing twice as much as normal during the pandemic because they had all this unstructured time. So if you are one of those people, please take on extra service responsibilities in the coming year and try to protect those people who didn't have those research opportunities this year by giving them a little less responsibility outside of research.
I love that advice. What are some areas of mathematics in which women in particular are seeing real growth and expansion?
I mean, I would say all of them. In my first like major math meeting, I occasionally saw women. There were women there, but you know, you'd see a big stream of people before you spotted a woman. And now it feels much more heterogeneous at these big math meetings. So I think we've, in my lifetime, we've made tremendous progress in getting women in the door. But I would say that the old biases of the hierarchy of like certain math subfields being quote unquote more important or more difficult than others has slowed down the progress of women's achievement in those areas. So we have a lot of work left to do. And I would say that some of the recent progress is directly attributable to AWM's research networks that support collaborative research groups of women mathematicians in specific subdisciplines of math. And so just the visibility of a whole chunk of women in a specific research area makes it really hard to ignore that there are women that you could invite to speak, for example, or collaborators that you can reach out to.
Have those research networks been able to keep up during the pandemic as well?
Yeah, in fact, I just ran a workshop last week for my SHAPE research network. We were supposed to go to Oaxaca, but instead I sat in my living room on Zoom. But the workshop itself was great. The groups were able to make progress even though they weren't in the same spot. And so other research networks have done that as well.
Are there any research networks that are particularly active?
Well, the Women in Numbers was the first research network. So they started in 2008, and they are just going gangbusters. The Women in Shape research network was the second one, and we also have quite a bit of longevity. Other than that, Women in Computational Topology, Women in Analysis, many of them are still quite active.
So what does it look like when these research networks are heavily involved in AWM? I know obviously that some of them publish volumes with us, which is wonderful. What else does that look like on the AWM side?
So typically a research network starts with a research collaboration workshop where women researchers come together for a week of intensive work on an open problem. So we have form research groups with a senior person who defines the project and leads the group. And then within the group, you might have senior people, junior people, graduate students, postdocs, all working together on a project. And then the collaboration continues after the workshop is over, culminating in ideally an article in one of these Springer volumes that you mentioned, the Springer AWM Proceedings volumes. And then also we have follow-on activities at the major math meetings. We'll have AWM special sessions that are organized by people involved in a research network that's recently had a research collaboration workshop where the speakers are drawn from that community and often talk about the work that they've done specifically in one of the workshops. Each network has a website, each network has a listserv for communicating with each other. I would say that this is a made-up statistic, but I would say that the editorial board of La Mathematica is at least half people who participated in a research collaboration conference at one time or another. So So a lot. There's a lot of inner.
Really a lot. Thank you for the perfect segue into talking about La Matemática, which is such an exciting new venture that I know has been quite a while in the making. And you're involved as an editor-in-chief, of course. So how is La Matemática setting itself apart from other mathematics journals?
Well, it starts with the people. So 77% of our editorial board are women, and more than 35% are people of color. And just for comparison, there's a 2016 article from the QSight Institute that looked at the gender breakdown of math journals. Journals with the highest representation of women were around 25% women. And the overall proportion of women out of 13,067 editors was 8.9%. In fact, 62% of math journals had zero women editors.
Oh, wow.
So this is really unprecedented. So we're hoping to set an example for other journals who think that they can't find these people. These people are out there. We found them. Here's a list, but please don't steal our editors. We also did a lot of research on best practices for equitable review processes. Mm-hmm. I personally have had many conversations with graduate students and recent graduates who are just in tears over the referee reports that they've gotten back from their very first like submission ever mm-hmm. to a journal, just being unnecessarily harsh and making personal attacks. So the review process that we ended up with is a doubly anonymous review, which is pretty common in other disciplines, but is actually a little controversial in math. And we periodically get emails from people yelling at us for this. But it's multiple studies have shown that this reduces bias in article evaluations. We have a two-stage review process to help reduce the time to a rejection. So I've had articles rejected like 2 years after I submitted them. For someone who's trying to get a job or get tenure, that's just mm-hmm. not feasible. So we have a quick review process where we send articles out just for a quick read-through to get an evaluation if this is an article that's appropriate for us and should move on to the next stage and be sent out to regular reviewers or not. And then the regular sort of traditional review process is the second stage. So that hopefully will produce reasonably quick turnaround in perpetuity. And then we're going to be doing regular evaluation and reporting of results about equity, how many articles are being submitted by people from different demographics, what's the acceptance rate, continuing to keep track of our editorial board demographics, things like that. And then for the articles themselves, we're really emphasizing readability. So we really want to be sparking innovation and connection, supporting folks to find new ideas, connect fields between fields, make connections between techniques. And so we ask that every article have a highly readable introduction and conclusion for people who might be outside the field. We don't expect your proofs to be understandable to anyone, but someone who is outside your field should be able to read parts of the paper and understand why it's an important contribution and what sorts of tools are being developed and how those tools might be helpful in other contexts. And then we really want to be supportive of interdisciplinary projects and collaborative work. So we have a very large tent for what we define as math, which again is often not customary in math. I say that most mathematicians define math to be the smallest circle that contains their work. But we're trying to do the opposite and say, if you think that what you do is math, we'd love to see what your contributions are and see if they're appropriate.
So interesting. And do you find that the contributions fit what you imagine math to be? Has anything surprised you or...
So far, so good. I mean, I think every journal gets some submissions from people who are not mathematically trained and so who don't really understand like the level that's appropriate for publication in a research journal, but everything that's been submitted has definitely been math.
So the first issue is entirely invited. So what sort of material were you seeking out for this very first issue?
So we invited, as I said, all of the AWM past presidents and prize winners and fellows and people who have been previously recognized by the AWM for their work to submit something of their choosing. And we really encouraged each submitter to think of this article as being a way to like lay out their vision for their particular field and talk about the future and new directions. So we're really thinking of these articles as being like a blueprint across a wide number of subdisciplines within math of where research is going and possibly sharing where it's been. And like we have almost the full range of math subdisciplines from math education to math history, and then all of the kind of more traditional research-oriented math topics. So
it's so interesting to see all this growth of the organization, of the publication. How would you say the organization has evolved in recent years? You know, obviously, publication advances aside.
Right. So I guess two things. One is, so we're at our 50th year, so we've been doing a lot of navel gazing to try to, you know, sort of figure out exactly where we are and where we want to go in the future. And I would say particular, so I would say that the first 50 years was like getting us in the door. So getting women in the door of academia. And this happened in many small steps. And the most recent step has really done a lot to raise the visibility of women in math. And that's the research networks that we've already talked about. So I think we have done a really great job of creating like separate networks where women can become successful. And moving forward, we really want to reintegrate the sort of vision we have for the mathematical world back into the full mathematical community. So someone said, oh, it sounds like now that you're in the house, you're looking around and seeing how you want to remodel the house. And I think that's absolutely true because the current system doesn't work really well for a lot of people who have great mathematical talent. So moving forward, we're going to be focusing on things like more opportunities for developing inclusive leadership skills for women, making policy recommendations about systems like student evaluations, which are well studied and known to be biased, tenure processes, the recent increasing reliance on non-permanent faculty and recommending moving back to a more stable employment model. The assumption that people can just up and move across the country multiple times for graduate school, for postdocs, for tenure track jobs during the 20s and 30s when they're trying to form family stability. And then moving from the kind of old school apprenticeship models of training the next generation more to mentorship models and co-equal, you know, research discovery, things like that.
Wow. Do you have specific programming or initiatives kind of set up in place, or these are, you know, the list of things to explore? What can we look forward to from AWM in the next few years?
Yeah, so we're in the process of developing professional development around inclusive leadership. And we recently, it's not like officially stamped yet, but we were recently notified that the NSF will be providing some funding for us to do things like that. We have a policy and advocacy committee that is currently in the process of putting together online resources around systemic challenges like student evaluations, tenure, racial and ethnic bias, things like that. But the larger questions are not something that we can like fix in a year. Mm-hmm. Like this you have to move all over the country thing has been, you know, from the very beginning of academia. So that's going to take more thought and long-term planning and getting input from a bunch of different communities, things like that.
So has there been any difference in things like that now that there's been COVID? I mean, I think one thing that people have found to be, I hesitate to say a positive change, but one thing that has come forth is there's so much more remote connection. so much more opportunity for collaboration all over the world. Has any of that sort of factored in making a difference in these areas, or you think everybody wants, you know, to push back to exactly where we were as soon as possible or somewhere in between?
Yeah. So my hope was, so the one thing that I saw during the pandemic that was like truly inspirational is the amount of compassion and grace that people were giving to each other. So we were all keenly aware that other people might be going through some huge ordeal or tragedy at the moment. And so when people disappeared or didn't respond immediately, we gave a lot of room. We gave a lot of space. But of course, that's true all the time. We have no idea what other people are going through. Anyone at any time might be having some major event in their lives, or just need a little extra, you know, positive reinforcement instead of, you know, berating them for being late or whatever. So I think that if we could carry that through out of the pandemic, kindness, humor, gentleness, patience, then we'd go a long way toward just fundamental culture change. But unfortunately, I am seeing just a mad rush back to normalcy as quickly as possible without a lot of like critical thinking about what we want to keep and what we want to leave behind. I also personally loved the social isolation. so this transition,
I'm with you.
This transition has been back to quote unquote normal is a little rough.
But, yeah. And obviously things aren't the same everywhere. So as it is kind of, as it is an international organization, and I imagine you have international students. I mean, do you see that coming up, this difference between being in America where we're so, you know, largely vaccinated and.
Absolutely. But I mean, that's another thing that exists outside the pandemic. People, you know, conference organizers assume that everyone can travel wherever their conference is, but a lot of students who are international students in the US don't have visa permission to leave the country and come back. And so if you, as I did, organized a workshop that was supposed to happen in Oaxaca, Mexico, I was necessarily excluding a bunch of people. So I think just continuing to think about like all of the ways that people are in different situations, as you said, is good. And I know also like some schools are being very specific about which vaccines they'll allow for coming back to campus. And some of those vaccines aren't available in the countries where the students are, things like that.
So do you think you would like to continue virtual collaboration? And do you think research networks might hang on to it a little bit, you know, go sort of more hybrid with things or?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say before the pandemic, the research networks were doing remote collaboration. My first research collaboration workshop was in 2013. And I picked up a couple of now long-term collaborators in France. And ever since then, we've had weekly meetings at 8 a.m. my time, 5 p.m. or 4 p.m. their time, depending on what the time zone is, the daylight savings is. So I think a lot of networks were operating remotely already, in between the workshops and conferences.
That's great, because now there are so many more resources to do it in so many different ways.
Yes, absolutely. Everybody has Zoom now, so we don't have to talk about which platform we're using.
Yeah, and everybody knows what it is, which is new.
Yeah.
Okay, then let's jump right ahead. What was your plan B if you couldn't be a mathematician?
That's hard to say. I started out as an English major in college, and so I came late to math, and so maybe math was my plan B. But if I had to pick a plan B after math, it would probably be being a lawyer. I really was attracted to the reasoning through arguments and unpacking consequences of rulings in a bunch of different applications, which is very much like math. But then I learned that most lawyers don't actually do much of that kind of work, and it's mostly like contracts and bureaucracy. So I'm happy that I am a mathematician and I don't have to go with plan B.
Sounds like that worked out. And what's the next virtual or not conference or meeting that you plan to attend?
Well, I have two virtual meetings coming up this summer. I'll be at the Society for Industrial and Applied Math annual meeting. at the end of next month. That's remote. And also remote is the Math Association of America's Math Fest in August. And so I'll be introducing prize winners and going to look at graduate student poster sessions and things like that at both of those.
Very nice. Jumping over to other media, is there any movie that you would recommend for our audience?
You know, during the pandemic, I really needed escapes that didn't require any sort of emotional engagement, but were still interesting enough to keep me distracted and had like a compelling storyline. And so these aren't movies, and I'm not a Trekkie, but I really enjoyed the Star Trek Discovery and Lower Decks series over the last year. So if you watch a bunch of them in a row, it sort of feels like you're watching a movie. So that's my answer.
Maybe. Trekkie in training.
Yeah.
All right. Suppose you are on a desert island. How could math help you survive?
I mean, in a sense, that's how math came to be. People were trying to understand the world to better survive. So they started doing things like plotting the sun and figuring out harvests and tidal fluctuations and things like this. So yeah, I'd probably do that. I'd try to figure out, you know, when and where I should be planting things and when I might expect tides to come in, and if I could figure out a nice current that might take me away from my desert island back to the mainland. Though, frankly, with the social isolation conversation we just had, maybe I'd be perfectly happy there. Unclear.
So how could math help you survive after you spent a good 30 days or so there?
Away from everything? Right. Exactly.
And last one, what would you tell your 17-year-old self?
Man, so this one is a little tricky. So my childhood was pretty challenging, and things really came to a head when I was 17. So at that point, I had dropped out of high school. I was essentially homeless. I was essentially disowned unless I was willing to be institutionalized. And I really had never lived for any lengthy period of time not in a crisis. So I would tell that poor young woman that she is going to live a life that is incredible and beyond her wildest dreams, that she will be full of love and curiosity about the world, that she will find stability. She'll be surrounded by positive, supportive people who will bring joy to her life. And that she has the strength and the skill to live through this thing she's going through right now and worse and come out the other side whole and happy.
Well, I really can't imagine a better ending than that. And now that I am tearing up, I am going to say thank you so, so much for sharing that, for sharing everything, for coming on the podcast to talk about your work and AWM. I am so grateful to have you and to celebrate this little bit of the 50th anniversary with you. So thank you so much for joining us. And I look forward to listening to the final version with you.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to chat today.
Thank you for listening to the Springer Math Podcast. Look out for another episode next month.